So I think today we are, the field is going is everybody agree needs to be more data-driven, improve the variety of success of drugs, get more drugs out with the better population. But you need to being able to take horizontal bets. It's like finding a panda in a zoo.
A baby panda in a zoo.
Yeah, a baby panda in a zoo. I mean, venture capitalists ate way less bamboo, but you still really have to find them. It's a rare species.
Parents built Actalion, Idorsia. How did it feel and how did it impact you?
Having a social impact in life give you less pressure because you did your best.
Hey, I'm your host, Philip, and welcome to the Flawed Bio Show, where I interview the best Europeans in biotech to help you grow. Today, I am online to talk with Thomas Klausel, who is the co-founder and the CEO of Orchid. And Thomas founded the co-founder company in 2016, and we talked just after, around 2017, for the first time. And it was just the beginning, and I have to say, I wasn't sure where it'd go. But today, it's a different story. It's a billion-dollar company following an investment from Sanofi in 2021, $118 million, $1 billion valuation, and has a team of over 300 employees. Amazing journey so far. And so we will talk about AI or scaling AI in biotech, as well as how it feels to be the son of two biotech billionaires. So let's connect our line and talk with Thomas. Welcome to us. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Philippe. Good to be here.
It's great to have you as well. It's good it worked out. We tried for, I think, 4 or 5 months
for the slot. Pretty much.
We made it before 2023, the end of 2023. It's perfect.
That was the goal.
All right. So for today, I think before challenging you on like Orkin, like specifically, I would like to start with, let's say, the bigger picture in AI. I get this request a lot. I mean, it seems like there are a lot of things happening, obviously super hot topic, a lot of deals being announced. I think it's one of the fields, maybe with obesity drugs in biotech, where you have like, where it outperformed everything else. But at the same time, I mean, I think it's super complex to understand, both from a technological point of view, also kind of a bit of a fear of missing out, fear of being replaced, whatever. You hear this like big AGI and everyone's job will be replaced. So, can you maybe start on the, let's say, on the top level view, what's above Orkin and from a field perspective of like,
yeah,
what's it's a different category, especially as it is like today, as we act and today.
Yeah. No, you know, so my vision is really like, you know, the pharma model has to be changed. The probability of success, as you know, is super low. The pharma has spent a lot of money to create great drugs. Most pipelines are really empty. You know, many pharma depends on one drug, you know, only. And so there is a lot of things to be done. And the thing that is even the most, like, you know, probably doable as a challenge to help the pharma space is so many steps are based on intuition. And they could be replaced by data. And you want to go from an intuition-based model to a data-driven model to improve the probability of success and the number of drugs that can be out. I think that's really where the field has to stand. Another question is, how do you actually do it? And so for us and for me, the answer is using really good data and artificial intelligence. I think like today, where the field is going is to be able to replace the pharma. A lot of people are taking very vertical bets. Vertical on just doing drug discovery or doing clinical trials or doing diagnostics. My vision is things cross-fertilize way more. You can find biomarkers that can help you find new targets or find the right population or the right indication or help you for a clinical trial and even do diagnostics with the same biomarkers and the same biology. And my vision is like biology can help, you know, for the full life cycle of the drug. And therefore, bets should be more horizontal than actually vertical. And it's not only vertical by the which part of the pharma you want to help. It's also vertical by modality. People are just doing, you know, AI for pathology or AI for omics or foundation model for proteins. But, you know, only the multimodal aspect of it can capture the right biology and the right way to help. So I think today the field is going is everybody agreed needs to be more data-driven, improve the probability of success of drugs, get more drugs out with the better population and better, but you need to really like being able to take horizontal bets and not go to the vertical side of it. I don't know if that resonates with you, but
yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think that's one of the big selling points of Orkin. You should have brought it to Orkin.
Yeah,
which is good. But what you mentioned, what I like also, maybe you can comment on there is like, I mean, you mentioned optimizing drug discovery, optimizing clinical trials, optimizing, let's say, in there you have patient stratification, optimizing, looking for biomarkers, all of that. And then even then optimizing, let's say, the really in the healthcare and how the drugs are prescribed or given, and you, in, let's say, in a hospital setting, you can optimize a lot of things. But maybe there to understand a bit more, because I mean, you guys, you are trying to go pretty horizontal.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think if you take these different categories, I mean, Hawking, you're going very horizontal and try to cross, except wet lab, if I understood
correctly. No, we have a wet lab.
No. You have a wet lab. Okay, so you're really going full horizontal.
Yeah.
But if you go into the categories, I mean, if I look, there is in the just some really in drug discovery doing whatever, like virtual cells. It's the first one that comes to my mind, or like really, like let's say specific step of the drug discovery. You mentioned pathology. I think like Path.ai is probably one of your biggest competitors, really on like data
pathology.
Pathology, but it's pretty big also. But on the and then the bigger differentiation is the ones who have their own pipeline versus the one who do deals with biotech and pharma companies who don't have pipelines.
So can I comment on
that? Yeah, go for it.
I try to decipher the categories. So I mean, like the question of the pipeline is a bit different. First, the big question is, what is the problem you're solving? Okay. For Hawking, we are trying to solve the precision medicine problem. Why precision medicine does not happen? I was a clinician, and you know, when you treat patients the same way, pretty much, it's frustrating. So for us, like the view of precision medicine was, we don't have the right diagnostic tools to be able to augment the care in predicting response to treatment or survival and whatever. And we just don't have enough drugs. And when we have drugs, they're not matched to the right population. So the matching of population to biology is a real problem for the pharma. So we believe that the problem we wanted to solve was precision medicine, and therefore we had to bring the diagnostic tools, AI enabled, and new therapeutics in the right subgroups. So this is really the precision we take. So this is, I mean, we are trying to solve this problem, and the only solution is to rebuild a full end-to-end pharma. That's really the thing we do. So I think how to decipher the field in general, I think it's first, it's not about creating a pipeline or not creating a pipeline. Everybody has in tech bio to create a pipeline. Okay. The big question is, our pipeline is diagnostics and therapeutics. Other people is therapeutics. The question is your pipeline really data-driven? A lot of companies, you know, have built a really amazing platform, for example, Knowledge Graph platform, but then had taken experts to choose the pipeline. So first, the question is your pipeline completely driven by your technology and not by a few experts? Because if you do a great platform, great technology, but then you go with a few expert-driven decision, you're not really making a revolution in the model. That's the first point. And the second point is your pipeline better than the real pharma? Have you found things that the pharma would not have found itself? Not only faster, but better in indications that failed in the pharma, glioblastoma, mesothelioma. And if you want to really be there, you have to wait for clinical proof of concepts, which is a phase 2B in oncology, for example. And you really have to show clinical proof points. I mean, so the question is your pipeline linked to the platform? And is your pipeline proven to be better? And there is no really other option to show that. And the third point is, then this is what the second thing you can prove. So the first thing you can prove. But then if you want to prove like even bigger metrics, like probability of success, can you, for example, double probability of success? What we want to do at Hawking, go from 10 to 20%, for example. You really have, you need a lot of trials. You need a lot of clinical trials to be able to show it. Yeah. I think the problem as well is nobody can do the claim today that they have been able to improve probability of success by better chemistry, by better clinical trials, by better targets, because you need so many trials to show it that there is no big claims that can happen. And this is the big problem. Acceleration has been shown. Augmentation, we still have to be proven, and we are all here in the same game. And to finish on that, the solutions part of it, the solution, the services, you know, for me, the services is only a way to cross-fund your own pipeline. You have to get your own pipeline, otherwise you have no IP. You cannot be a big business being a solution provider. So for us, we are doing a lot of big contracts with pharma to learn from them, but also to get enough cash to cross-fund our diagnostic and therapeutic pipeline. I mean, for me, this is how I view it. But you have seen a lot, so you can tell you may have other.
Yeah, no, it's great. Can you, and there's at least a few questions I want to jump in, a few points I want to jump in, but maybe can you be a bit more specific or mention, let's say, the other players, to see how they compare to you? I mean, without like trash talking them, but just more like to...
No, I don't want to talk about it. I think first, so we're very different. We AI for biology because we believe that biology is the background to discover new biomarkers that can feed the full life cycle. What we don't do is chemistry, okay?
Okay.
Why are we not doing chemistry today? Because I think chemistry space has improved incredibly with AI, the space of molecules, but there are still things that are unsolved, like protein to protein interaction and others. And today, if you ask me, should I use AI to help chemistry? Yes, absolutely. But I still need the real good chemist in the lab. Can be from Germany, can be Switzerland, and I still believe that you really have still to get really good chemistry in the wet lab, and AI is a help. So today this is why we choose to not do chemistry ourselves for now. The rest, finding new biomarkers, new biology, new targets, match it to the right population, use these biomarkers to find the right subgroup and indication, improve clinical trials, synthetic control arms, covariate adjustment, and develop a diagnostic tools to be able to deploy the subgroup is really where the rest, what we are doing. And I think nobody's really doing that today. So first, I think the only ones that do the end-to-end pharma, we really want to recreate a mini Roche, if we can. Yeah. Very, very mini, very small. But, I think this is what we want to
step
do.
The best step.
The best step. Other players are, a lot of other players are in the chemistry space. That's the first one. Other players can be in the biology space as well. Try to discover new biology. If you take, in situ or recursion, they're amazing, but they're using cell lines. For me, as a clinician, if you don't have the macroenvironments, even if you're using cell lines or organoids, you still miss the macroenvironment, the immunity. And I don't have a huge belief in finding new biology in mechanisms with such a translational gap. And for me, the only way to reduce translational gap is using patient data. You still have to validate in the lab. But as my CEO is always saying, cancer was treated in mice 30 years ago. So we have to find a new model. And for me, the model is patient data as well. And biology has to be discovered in very large patient data sets, deeply phenotype, using new modalities such as spatial transcriptomic. It's a very important one. We're doing this big mosaic project. And you have to get with an angle of finding new biology that is not cell line driven.
But isn't then a bit challenging, but even today, you said you had a wet lab as well, but you don't do the chemistry. Isn't the optimal to combine, let's say, in situ with you guys, so you have the really patient stratification, microenvironment, bigger like patient picture at the same time with the biology cell line, really the chemistry biology, and you can kind of combine and cross fertilize.
So we're doing it too. So we created the Okinab, and in Okinab, what we are doing is using organoids, and we're partnering with Sun Bioscience in Lausanne. They're amazing persons. You should be interviewed the co-founders. And so we're using organoids in the lab as well to test our hypothesis. Mm-hmm. But first hypothesis are being formed in patients. That's the difference, And then we use a really big lab-in-the-loop approach where we're creating perturbation screens to improve our models. So I'm not saying the lab is still a very central place, but I still believe the first type of biology has to come from the patients. And we show it in the mesothelioma paper we published in Nature Medicine 4 years ago. We could discover new mechanisms using a prediction from patients' digital pathology and reverse engineering the model to understand new cell biology or gene biology that could explain different phenotypes. And there was a new discovery in mesothelioma. But the first step was having a lot of patient data access, multimodal, making a prediction and reverse engineering. And then you go to the cell lines and the organoid model to validate. But for me, the first thing has to be having 10 times more data. And when I say data, it's also private data in the best hospitals. Data from the patients with cupid leaders. I don't believe in public data sets. If you build your company on public data sets, and some have done that,
the quality of the data influences massively the quality of your models, and it's directly linked. So you need really high quality data.
And diverse.
And
No, because the thing about diversity, everybody always remembers that patient diversity matters, of course. But doctors' diversity matters too. Patients are being treated very differently in Europe and in the US, even in France. You go to Paris and you go to Lyon, you have a different treatment probably for the same tumor. And so, if you don't capture this type of heterogeneity of biopsy, of treatment and everything, you have a model that is not robust. And by definition, AI is not robust. And this is why you need to have European data as we do at Okin and not only US patients. This is why, data from Flatiron, for example, have no use to do research. And also just because the clinical data, they're not multimodal, but also just US-based in community centers. We don't believe in community access so much. We believe in best academic centers where you have key opinion leaders that help you curating really high-quality data sets to go to the single cell level.
Do you think Roche agrees with that when they hate?
I think Roche agrees. I mean, come on. Today
was it 3 billion, the deal with Flatiron or something?
So the deal was huge. And Roche wanted to, the story of Roche is simple. Roche wanted to make the first move with Flatiron. They really wanted to be the first. Then they bought Flatiron. Flatiron was super useful for market access, useless for research, very, very little useful for synthetic control arms. Synthetic control arms using just Flatiron data is not proved to be very efficient. Then what they did is they bought Foundation Medicine, which was great. They tried to reconciliate both. There was only like 30,000 patients, you know, in common. And they just show that it was very hard for them to get multimodal data as this way to do really great research. I think now with Aviv Regev, they're really trying to rebuild, you know, spatial symptomic data sets as Hawking has done before, you know, and trying to go to building a new data lake. And I think they're taking the right strategy. But I think like the Flatiron was great for market access, not good for research, not very useful for clinical trials. And the reconciliation was very hard. Tempus is doing better in taking, you know, the multimodal data from scratch. What is different from us is we are embedded within hospitals, so we can continuously enrich the data set. We can add new things, spatial symptomic, long reads, single cell. And so we can always, like, you know, enrich this. And we don't have a static view like, you know, this type of companies do have. And I think like Roche has been a bit jealous of Tempus' approach in the past. And I think that they're really trying to take things from scratch on the genetic side.
Okay. I will link it below, but there's a good article in Endpoints about the head of AI from Genentech/Roche on what he's building, and it's
I think it's amazing. Yeah, Aviv Regev is trying to build something amazing. I mean, I think what they tried to build, but they start from scratch, and they do exactly like us: patient data, spatial symptomic, and I'm so happy that we have inspired Roche. Maybe they won't admit it, but we're doing this.
get this quote there. That's a basic. I want to know a bit on you said our AI in biotech hasn't augmented or hasn't shown the augmentation yet. Can you go a bit into what's the differentiating basically the vision of, let's say, what could be done in 5 years versus what has been done really today and in, let's say, in the last 5 years, and where do we really stand?
I think there's lots of great companies around. You know, I can name them: Exantia in silico, you know, PathAI, PGI, Recursion. I think they're all great, and we're all doing quite different things, and we're all a bit playing with the pharma. I think what happened with the pharma today, the pharma has first the story of the pharma and AI. At the beginning, they wanted to do a lot of internal innovation, okay? Build the things internally. Then they started to realize that the problem is they cannot do it for two reasons. They have a very hard time building their own data lakes, okay? Very hard time to regroup their own data. And second, they're not hiring the best data scientists. Why are not the best data scientists going to the pharma? When you're really good data scientist, you want to work for Google when you're young, not for, Roche or Novartis. It's sad, but it's true. I hope it's going to change. I really believe the best in the future will work for the big pharma. But today, the truth is the young data scientists, super brilliant, they want to work for, Metafair or Google. I don't know, but it's still not super attractive. And I hope it's going to change. And then they really understood they have to do more external innovation. And they try to play with a lot of different players around. And I think they all make proof of concept. And we all make proof of concept with them. Sometimes we did not bring pipeline value. Sometimes we were bringing things that were incremental, but then the CEO was coming and saying, oh, my pipeline changed thanks to this company. I want to see my pipeline changed. And so you had the head of discoveries that was amazing and tell you, hey, we did that. But the CEO was, I want to see difference in my pipeline. And I think the how you can bring direct pipeline value really mattered, you know, I think in the for the pharma. And I think all of us, maybe we were sometimes too upstream to show pipeline value. And this is why, you know, we did a lot of clinical trials improvements to really show things that were more direct than very early discovery or diagnostic tools to improve, you know. But I think, yeah, this was the problem for all of us. And I think today the pharma wants to have less partners, a few partners. And they will have one chemistry partner. They have a lot of great companies around, you know, in silico, Exantia, amazing. And they might have a one for biology, you know, us, another. But I think in the future, they have less partners. Another question is why the pharma has not really acquired, but BioNTech and InstaDeep. And InstaDeep was a great team. They were a really amazing team. And I think they made a really good move. I think today, you know, I think the pharma is still a bit scared of the cultural difference. Yeah. They would be scared that if they acquire a company, people would leave. And I don't think it's true. I think like people understand that it's complementary, and I think people will stay. But I still think this is maybe the reason why the big M&A has not really happened, like the Flatiron level.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe. What do you think? Why is this M&A not, you know?
I can feel that they are trying to wrap their head around as well, and probably still like going one foot after a time, like touching the ground, seeing okay, and testing here and there. And I think the culture thing is probably like, it seems like a really big shift. I mean, you always have like biotech versus tech bio and really this tech aspect. And I can imagine, let's say data scientists or AI engineer, it's not just the salary, it's a package, but it's also really from a culture point of view. If you work for a big tech firm or even for you guys, it will probably fit or it will be much closer to that kind of culture that the person needs or where the person will strive than, let's say, a really big pharma. I can imagine. So this, I mean, to your point, this, I can imagine. And it's a big shift. I mean, for me personally, coming from, let's say, more tech, I mean, half tech, half biotech, but I can see in the industry there's really a big mindset shift. And I worked for some like a bit larger organization, biotech or pharma, and just the way they're working and the culture, they're great cultures, but it's, I think, very hard to fit with someone who is really like in AI or in tech. It's really from an operation thing. I mean, I'm thinking about, okay, they're still working, you know, on email and PowerPoints, and they don't have a project management software and some basic things, which for me was like, wow, it's insane. Yeah. And you're a billion-dollar company, but you have no like project management whatsoever, which I can imagine for some...
Yeah, and I think things that, however, things are a bit changing, you know. Take the example of Sanofi, like, you know, the headquarters of Sanofi looks more like a startup, a type of office. And I think people are a bit less corporate. The mindset is a bit changing.
You see that, yeah?
But I think it's in the pharma, we start to have like people like CEOs or our head of BD Global that start to be really like interested in the topic, like profoundly, or even chairman. Take Sanofi, you know, like in Palo Alto and really love AI, and like the new CEO, the new chairman, sorry, for the good AI is really has a deep, you know, interest for it. You know, take BMS as well, you know, the team at BMS is really interested in at the C-level role. I mean, I think at the same time, it's having C-levels that truly believe, don't only want to have an AI bread, but really want to understand with companies like all of us, where there will be impact. And I think this is also like where we need to go. There is other company in the pharma that have way more classical CEO-ship.
Do they really get it? Or are they still in the more curiosity, like,
I don't know. I think some are really. I still the deep diving in it, and I think it's not just only about being an AI company having a brand. They really want to show things, but they want to show that we can bring pipeline value once again. And this is where I think they want to say to the world: this is pipeline is AI driven, and this pipeline has shown success where we failed. This is where the hardest part is.
So I want to switch gears a bit from, I mean, we talked a lot about big pharma and pharmas, but I mean, you have also all the like biotech companies, let's say small and medium size, who are pushing a lot of like innovative drugs. And I'm curious in their case, how they can really use it in biotech. I mean, from what you said first was like, oh, like basically big pharma or anyone has to be like AI first and have an AI pipeline, which means even the biotech company would have to internalize some stuff, or should they like work with some partners for discovery, for the clinical trials? What's your view there? Really for biotech companies, let's say whatever, Selectus, clinical stage by the company.
So first, I think some are very involved in it. I take names like GeneMap. I also have been very driven in AI and help a lot of different stuff. Of course, the problem of, you know, I think like for AI companies like us, the opportunity is amazing to be able to get in licensing drugs from those and maybe also just to, you know, maybe have revenues, royalties. It's very hard to get royalties with the pharma. You know, you get clinical milestones, but royalties maybe like, the biotech will be more open to it, even if you prove your value. And I think so. This is it. The problem, of course, is biotech has less money to spend and doesn't participate in the business as much. So, you know, for companies like the Tech Bio ones, the big pharma is a bit like, you know, can invest in the equity rounds. So it's a bit more structural in a way. But I think both are very important at different levels to work with.
But not just like partner with you guys, but more how you perceive it. Basically, what should they do? What do you think they should do? Because I got the question from, let's say, VP Discovery at a biotech company, 100 employee, 1 billion, having next-gen biologics platform. And she was like, oh, what do you think about AI in biotech? Like, what should I do? How can I use AI in biotech? And how can I use AI? Like, what would you think?
If you ask me for like a single asset biotech in a mid-size, it depends on the fields. I would go for what brings the most direct value, which is, for me, finding the right subgroup. Everybody knows that finding the right subgroup for your drug can improve the probability of success. But matching biology to the right population, finding the right subgroup, or maybe the right indication, is not easy for startup. Most in oncology, they never know which indication they want to go to, and then they have to build very expensive basket trials and take a lot of risks. I would go, if I was a single asset, to take a company that can help me on identifying the right subgroup and the right indication for my drug before I go, help me positioning the drug really well. I mean, of course, I'm taking a look-in use case, but I would start with this use case very simply, and all the others that can do that.
And what about a non Hawking use case?
No, but it's about Hawking use case. No, I think no, because the problem of a single asset is not having a better pipeline. A bigger pipeline is even more having the success of your first drug, right?
In this case, it was a platform company actually with research. So
in the platform company, I could also work with InSilico, you know, or on augmenting my pipeline with some of the new drugs. You know, why not? You know, I think both are complementary. I would choose one use case I don't want to explore, but I wouldn't try different things at the parallel. And I would really create a little common lab where people can meet. I mean, I love this idea of really having a common lab where people can exchange a lot. Or I would merge. Why not merging with a mid-size? Why not? I think mid-size biotech and AI scale-ups should merge together. In the future, because this is where I probably could work as well. Why not? You know,
it might
another option.
It might happen actually.
Yeah.
Let's see. No, that's great. I mean, we touched a lot of things already. Let me just check. Let's talk a bit about. I mean, on the competition, I'm still like, one thing I'm still wrapping a bit my head around is like, you said something, I think on podcast that you mentioned, you wanted to have 10 times more data, or let's say 10 times more and better data than anybody else. Like, this is a wish, but where do you stand today, like compared to
biggest? Look in our papers, we publish a cohort in mesothelioma on 3,000 patients, you know, to find some new biomarkers and new biology. This was in Nature Medicine. Today, we have another thing called Mosaic. Mosaic is the largest spatial transcriptomic effort. We are getting towards 7,000 patients data sets with 5 centers. This is the goal. And this is really to build, you know, a huge effect on the... I think it's going to be huge for the field, because we're going to be able to show that we can have huge data sets. It's a $15 million investment, 50, you know, and we are building the right pipeline to analyze it. Spatial transcriptomic is the only way to see visually genes expression and, you know, a tissue organization. It's an amazing play for computer vision. And I think this is the type of modalities that can also capture the microenvironments. It's the only way to capture the microenvironment effects. And so, you know, we're working with, like, you know, NanoString, 10x, and we're really building this, and 5 amazing centers to build this thing. And we were first, and we were really happy to see some competitors coming on our feet, like No Ethic, No From One Alpha coming afterwards. Mm-hmm. Once again, happy that we inspired people. You know, we are really building something that I think, but it has to be big, because if it's not big, if you don't have a size effect, you cannot validate things in the right way, test it, train things, test things, find the right hypothesis, and you never know if it's a data number thing or just a, you know, and you need to also capture the heterogeneity. So this is the type of efforts we are making. Very big bets, growth projects.
Yeah.
And we really aim to go super high.
Okay. Well, that sounds high.
High number.
High number. I mean, in the thousands of patients, it's already high. And I guess what you said is
7,000.
The quality of the
patients. The last cohort published. Yeah, I mean, everything is also about the quality and the multimodality. And I just want to just re-explain why multimodality matters. So you understand spatial transcriptomics matters to capture the microenvironment. But in general, when you work in cancer, and I'm an oncologist, right? So when you work in cancer, you never know which modality will give signal to the prediction. So if you do only pathology, like PathAI, you know, PAGE, sometimes pathology in lymphoma does not bring a lot of predictive signal. You really need other modalities. Even if you anchor your model on pathology, you need to add multi-omics. Sometimes, you know, CT scan or MRI or proteomics, you need to add other modalities because you never know where the signal will coming from. And so the multimodal approach is really complicated, but it's the only way to capture how you can understand the different scales of biology. So, I mean, for us, it's not only about being multimodal, it's also being multi-scale. How you go from a gene to a cell to a tissue, a tissue to a disease, capturing causal signal. And this is the very thing. So we really want to go to try to understand causality more than correlation. And the only way to do that is being multimodal and multi-scale. We're not there, but it's a big work. And this is really the goal.
But that's where also AI makes total sense, because you can process tons of data very rapidly and figure out the relationship, the causality, like really well and much, much better than any human can do.
I mean, yeah, but we haven't proved, I mean, nobody, even us, we are still trying to prove a good explanation. I mean, before causality, you have other like success levels, like good explanation of a disease or something like that. We have to go there too. But, you know, yeah, I mean, and what's also interesting about data is today, you know, we also have to get to foundation models on every data modality. So here you need like millions of patients, you know, if you want to build a foundation. And Hawkin is spin-offing his foundation model for biology, the first one that is going to be multi-scale on our data set. But we are really, you know, being able to work, you need millions of patients on pathology, millions of proteomic patients. And so this is where you need like, and then if to connect the scales together, you need like multimodal longitudinal data sets. So you need different type of sort of data and numbers when for the tasks you want to optimize. But you really like, you know, the number of data annotated, you know, not annotated, sorry, unlabeled, because you don't need that, is going to be big as well.
I looked into one company, actually Valo in Boston. I know quite well David Berry from Flagship for of 10 years, actually.
Yeah, me too.
And to my understanding, I mean, they're going a bit in a similar space, as in having a lot of human data and then building a pipeline on it. And from what I see or from their presentation, they are also in the thousands of patients scale. So how does that...
We have discovered, like, you know, very reference ways to analyze pathologies that we publish, you know, people are using, and the multimodal. I haven't really read so many papers in the literature in Nature Medicine like us or about Valo technology, so I don't know much about it.
Okay.
I haven't read like science, so I don't know. And then the thing is, like, we are building, like, you know, we are building, like, but I think David is great. He's probably have an amazing team. I mean, the idea of in-licensing drugs is a bit similar. We're also building diagnostic tools. And we are partnering with 41 of the largest hospitals in the world. I'm not sure which partner. For us, it's really a win-win partnership with the hospitals. We try to publish. We try to work with them. We are generating data against access. We also try to build a federated ecosystem of hospitals with 180 of the best key opinion leaders. I don't really know about the partnership and the quality of the data. I can say, you know, so I really don't know much about it to comment.
I mean, yeah, okay. I don't know exactly either, but I mean, they mentioned acquisition of data. So I guess they must, I mean, the data has to come from somewhere and probably the leading hospitals. And
when you acquire data, So the thing about acquisition, first, I'm a doctor. I like data to stay in the hospitals where they've been created. I don't like to acquire. I like to have a remote access. I don't need them to acquire them. We don't acquire data. We have a remote access to it because it's privacy preserving. I believe in privacy.
Yeah.
If you wonder, data is a commodity, it's the new oil. Try to wonder for every company, what is their policy? What is their vision on data access? Is it a sustainable way to access data? Is this good for the patients? I mean, for Hawkin, it's easy. It's a privacy-preserving access, you know, federated to break the research silos. We really want to break research silos and competitive silos between centers. You know, I think the at least it's clear. We were the first one, and we're still number one in federated learning for clinical data.
Yeah.
This is why Google Venture came in years ago. I think, like, today, the broking of data, it's something that I believe will happen and everywhere. But it's not a very amazing vision on data to, I mean, as a doctor, it's not mine.
Yeah. You switched to the next topic on federated learning. I mean, it sounds amazing, honestly, and I mean, you've proved that it worked. I mean, the Melody project was I think it was 10 pharma. You proved also that it worked with hospitals.
Yes.
But the other model of acquiring the data also seems to quite work, especially in the US. I think it's more a question of also of price. I mean, if a hospital, I don't know what time of deal we are talking about for this, but if it's in the millions to acquire, I mean, I think a hospital could be interested. And I guess there's a question of price, and then there's probably maybe some workarounds around privacy. Let's say if you anonymize the data, then you cannot identify the patients, then it's
so you cannot. That's never true, Philippe. That's not true.
No, okay.
That's not true. If you take, I put 40 hackers on any data set, I come back to the identity of anyone. Today, there is no anonymization of data that works out. We have to be very clear. None.
Yeah, why do Apple claim that anonymization of data?
Well, I'm pretty sure to try to give us data and put like 40 hackers. Why? Take a pathology slide, okay? Pathology slide, by definition, if you take the name out, whatever, you can anonymize, pseudo-anonymize it. Yeah. However, at Okin, we're able to predict genes based on this slide. We can predict signatures of genes on the pathology slide. If you predict the signature of genes, you're coming back to the genome of people, and you can really get back and you can cross with genealogy database, which is me, whatever. Today, I personally
predict the gene on the top level. You don't predict the sequence to then identify the patient. Like,
well, you still predict signatures of T cells or B cells, which is quite, you know, identifying. However, I mean, I'm just telling like the roots that could like predict more of this is the tumor, but you know, you can still I don't believe that. I mean, we have to prove. The only way to prove that something is really is to put a dozen hackers on the dataset and see if they cannot come back to it. I mean, for me, I mean, I'm not saying that federated or aggregation, and I'm still saying that it's fine to buy datasets, but I think both have to happen. In Germany, very hard to do data broadening, right? So that works for the US, but in the global scale.
Okay. I know the German problem, but I'm curious on this, like, where's the model? Because I mean, when you talk, it sounds like
the truth.
Yeah, it's good to hear you both, because when you talk or even podcast, it sounds always like the only solution is federated learning. But
no.
From the reality, I think. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, reality is between both. However, just can I say something? There have been deals in the past that were exclusive deals on data generation with hospitals and scale up. And this is not okay. We have to all be okay that we are trying. Everybody of us, every tech bio is trying to treat patients and help medicine. And if you make an exclusive deal that your data cannot be even used for internal research within the hospital, of course there is no commercial right when you generate data. That's okay, but you still want to things. You don't want to have a hold on data sets for anybody else. And we've seen it in the past. I don't want to name people, but you know, we know that there's been deals where the people couldn't do research, they couldn't participate with anybody else on even the data sets that were not generated before. And I think this is not okay. I mean, we have to see that if you put a hold on data sets and a key lock that nobody able to use, you're not helping research. And so we have to promote companies that are really trying to help open this system.
Well, I guess this will be it will be a very challenging problem, because I mean, data is basically new gold or whatever, and your model also, I mean, quality of the data improves. So if you increase the quality of the data or you decrease the quality of the competitor's data, maybe your model can be better or whatever. I mean, basically what Google is doing with YouTube, but they're not really sharing all the YouTube data to build the Gemini. I mean,
Just take the example of federated learning. I mean, take nice example of federated learning. Melody was the first time people were collaborating, and it was the largest database of small molecules virtually. But take the example of glioblastoma, very important to my heart, a brain tumor. You know, glioblastoma is 35 clinical trials. There is only one positive. I think it's Novocure, an amazing company, really. And so if you take, there is so many silos of negative trials happening in different pharma anywhere, and they will never share it. They will never share the negative clinical trial. If you do federated learning on that, you could really capture you could have enough data to find some new biomarkers for glioblastoma. It doesn't mean you will find a new molecule because there's still a long way to on the Killersley side. But however, it's very frustrating to know that people have silos of negative data, not collaborating, and that there is technical solution. Why are we not doing it at Okin? Glioblastoma is a small market, so we will have very low support from the pharma. We won't have enough money to do it. It costs a lot of money, and it's a big headache to work with multiple pharma with federated learning. So, you know, we're just not doing it because we don't have a business case. But yeah, it should happen. I mean, the data are here.
I mean, yeah.
Feels a pity.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to jump on what you said about that it's mostly a European problem. And I think that's, you're touching a point where I think it's probably one of the biggest value propositions of Okin. As in, I mean, GDPR and let's say Germany, even Switzerland are super strict on data privacy. So I guess, and also even for you as a Okin, as a business, I mean, I think still most of your employees are based in, let's say, Paris or Europe. And I think also most of your pharma partners are Europeans as well, even though you have some in the US as well. So
no.
Not true?
No. Only Sanofi. I mean, first, I don't think what is a pharma your partner is that all global. But I think today we have more US partners than pharma. In the pharma space, we have more US partners.
Are the US one partnering with you for the European data or as a, from a global partner?
People are partnering with us for two reasons. We are global data. We have as many hospitals in the US, even more than in Europe. But we have both. The second is the fact that we can enrich the data. When you acquire data, you cannot enrich it. You cannot get to a new analysis accessing the samples. We can theoretically access samples from the patients, of course, in a very strict ecosystem and with the. But you know, we work with the patients. We are really relational. We have a relationship with hospitals, and so people work with this federated access data worldwide. Then they work with us because we can bring the AI layer and the biomarker, and then we can implement this within the lifecycle of the drug. We are one-stop shop for the pharma in biology. This is why they work with us. We can do clinical trial, diagnostics, new therapeutics, indication discovery, so we're discovering new targets. So I think today they would like to work with us for that. And of course, they work on the chemistry with great players in silico, etc., whatever. So I think today this is where we stand. But we don't give access to our data anytime. So nobody has access to our data. We are in the middle.
Yeah. That's good. Maybe a last point on Okin is the transition to being, let's say, full-fledged or full biotech. I mean, you were saying, I think you heard you were, you want to reinvent the pharma biotech full stack. You mentioned a la Tesla, building everything end-to-end. I mean, you hired some big people. I mean, this is Andreas, the CFO of Molecular Partners, who joined you, and he built Molecular Partners, or co-founded Molecular Partners, co-founded another biotech company. You had the global SVP BD from Sanofi. I mean, some really like heavy, really biotech people, I would call it, biotech or drug development people. I'm curious on where, how are things going there on like building your own pipeline? I mean, I think it's been, these people joined a bit more 12 to 18 months ago. So how did it go there on the pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, so first we build a tech. Yeah, thank you for mentioning them. You know, we build a tech bio and it's led by Jean-Philippe Vert, who is one of the very top specialists in the world of AI for biology. You know, he used to lead Google Brain in Paris and professor at Berkeley and Paris and at Lemine. So on the, you know, we have an amazing data science lab and people. Then we also hired like a really great medical team, you know, Vasily Soumelis, who is a professor of immunology and hematology, to have a really medical expertise because we believe it's important. On the pharma side, what's hard is to find people from the pharma that are platform minds, you know, that have this, that have the sense of urgency and really want to accelerate things. It's not that easy. And I think, Alban de Sablière, our chief operating officer, came from Sanofi, and he has this sense of urgency. And Andreas brings this, like, you know, four IPOs. So I think we are building up. We're hiring a SVP drug discovery. You know, we are hiring people in the lab that have been through. So I think this is the hardest part for sure. It's finding the right people that can bring this this value. Still understanding the translational side of the tech. It's very hard. But I mean, there are people in the pharma space that do that. In the venture capital space, fewer, you know? Mm-hmm. Venture capital is another story. Very few people get both. You know, understanding what representation learning means, how you find the right data, and understanding, you know, the what is a really good pipeline or the diagnostic. I mean, it's pretty much a very rare species. It's like finding a panda in a zoo. You maybe have one every 100 zoo. I think like a mix
of... Maybe panda in a zoo.
Pandas around. Yeah, baby panda in the zoo. And I think like they eat, I mean, venture capitalists ate way less bamboo, but you know, we still really have to find them. It's a rare species.
Yeah, that's now that. And so specifically, where do you stand now in the pipe? Can you share anything?
Yeah, so we're gonna share with the list. We have two dynasty tools approved. You know, the first one is being deployed. It's called MSI Intuit. The second one is gonna come very soon. We have the first phase one coming in, and we really, you know, are working with the pharma. We are on 20 years of chemistry, a really like best in class drug. Everything we built in diagnostic is first in class. Everything we do in diagnostics in therapeutic is best in class. But once again, we are really trying to show, the big thing for us is try to show the world that it's not just another pipeline. Because a pipeline is a pipeline, you know, and you can have 100 molecules if it doesn't show really great success. And I think for me, for everybody in silico, Exenture, Recursion, Insitro, in silico, we all have the same problem, you know.
Yeah.
It's showing that our pipeline or Valo Health, showing the pipeline is different.
Yeah, everyone wants.
It's a hard one.
And I'm curious on the type of drug. Is it like small molecules only, or are you agnostic of the type of technology?
No, we're agnostic today. We're agnostic today. We're going to announce a big partnership with a very famous CRO on small molecules.
Yeah.
But we are open, you know, because we want to discover biology first. If you find like proteins at the surface, they can be only targeted by, you know, by biology. And there is good companies doing AI and good CRO on the you know, the biology side. Biologics is also important. We couldn't restrain us because we want to discover new biology first. So today we open. We don't have an internal expertise on one or the other. We externalize this expertise working with the best CRO there. It costs a lot of money, of course, but you know, we have to get there.
I mean, from my view, it's always something that's not puzzled me, but where I was a bit cautious was that most of the AI biotech, especially the ones doing their own drug development and having they're mostly doing small molecules, which I think is great, and there's still need for some amazing small molecules. But if you look at the pipes, most of the pharma, Sanofi, I think is like 90% of their pipe is biologicals or advanced therapeutics.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen that many AI biotech who have like breakthrough biologicals thing. And the first that came to mind where I was like, oh wow, was Exscientia, I think mid of this year, they announced that they have now they can generate antibodies, I think, or biologicals. And I was like, okay, now it starts to be like really, I mean, probably really interesting.
Very smart companies.
Yeah, yeah.
No, and there's so many mechanisms, especially in the microenvironment. Small molecules is not the solution. You can't.
Yeah.
First, it's biological first, but we don't, you know, once again, it's working with CROs. But the problem of biologics is, of course, like in a way, small molecules are a bit simpler, probably,
yep.
Because you have less optimization, you have less stuff to do, but the patent is shorter. There's a patent problem as well, creating a bit less value. I agree with you.
Do you think there is or at least from my view, was a bit like maybe the biological complexity at the moment was just too complex for Gen AI or AI in general to really to like manage? Is that one of the?
I think so, but also yeah. also yeah, probably the and this is the first part. I think the second part is accessing privacy data sets. It was the idea of Melody, accessing small molecule libraries from the pharma, not public ones. And you know, I don't think there is enough like access to really high quality private data of really high quality. With, once again, the idea of continuously, I really insist on the idea of being able to continuously enrich your data sets.
Yeah.
What happens is, okay, we can add new analysis if needed for the same patients. And this is really what matters because there are so many new technologies that are coming in. You want to be able to do that. And I think this is what missed in the chemistry space. A lot of people are using like public data sets to work on the chemistry side.
Mm.
And, you know, there might be a limitation too. But I think, I mean, come on, in silico, Exscientia, they're all doing a great job. They're doing great stuff.
It's Cosmos. I'm playing the devil's advocate here and trying to challenge you. I'm not trying to understand really like where the limitation, what's hype, what's reality, where is it standing? So I think you did a really good job
The first limitation is data. Yeah.
Thank you.
First limitation is data. Technology is the second, but data is always the biggest limitation. First. Always. And then, But I think, and then the other limitation is time to show proof points. Time to show that, you know, And this is the terrible thing about this field. And once again, the terrible thing is waiting 4 or 5 years to get your phase 2B showing that you prove something. Of course, you can accelerate and whatever. How? This is so frustrating. I mean, it's true for every biotech, right?
Drug development. I mean, you can bend time or bend a bit time, but once you know a bit the complexity of it, cannot cut too many corners. I liked what Mark de Garrida, actually, we talked about it, that you watched the episode, but he said that it's very hard.
Great episode, congratulations.
Thanks. It's very hard to find actually the balance between speed and quality in a clinical trial, because you have so much pressure to get faster in terms of capital limitation, and you want to help patients. But at the same time, if you compromise too much on the quality of the trial, it can backfire like pretty big times. So I like that quite a lot. I mean, in tech, you can cut a bit more corners and probably you can scale maybe faster. But in healthcare and with patients, I mean, we saw Theranos, we saw even 23andMe. I mean, when you cut too many corners,
it's a great vision. I mean, but I think 23andMe is...
It's better than Theranos ever. But still, there are some...
No, it's
discussable.
Yeah, but I like it because... but I like the fact that they're trying to take patient data and find molecule stuff, and I think they're doing a good job. I mean, one thing that is also very limiting is the phase one. Phase one is so... In oncology, it's so limiting. They all look the same. You never know. Mm. I think phase one is a big topic. We are trying to improve phase one. You know, trying to not finding evidence, you can't, but insights with counterfactual outcome, building like, trying to compare the response, the actual response to a predicted response. Sorry. But I feel like phase one in oncology, especially, is a big limitation because you never know what to think about it.
Yeah.
And we try to work on it.
That's a good point. I want to switch a bit the topic more to the personal side and talking about more your background and kind of your mindset. And the first thing that comes to mind is talking more about your parents and where you came from. Your parents built Actelion, Idorsia. I mean, super successful, one of the few, let's say, billionaires in biotech, at least in Europe. And must be, how did it like feel and how did it like impact you growing up that way?
Thank you. So first, my parents are doctors. You know, they're not like lawyers, like some of the CEOs are doctors. They really think about their patients. And they've been like putting up drugs that are amazing. Like for example, take the example of QUVIVIQ, is the last drug and it's building up. It's an amazing drug. It's revolutionizing sleep. I take it all the time. You dream more, you sleep so much better. And of course, it's not the success of Wegovy today. However, I believe that sleep and obesity are both very important for your life. And I hope we can. I think my patients are just like extremely like idealistic, also very sometimes maybe too much. Doctors. I think that my parents give me the patient first thing because they're doctors and I'm a doctor too, and that they teach me that patients matter first. And when you bring patients value, there is a business. At the beginning of Actelion, they were building something for pulmonary hypertension. People were telling them the market is too small, whatever. They were like, you know, this is the first one. And the second thing is, I think they also like show me that you need to trust in what you're doing because don't listen too much about people, you know? Mm-hmm. My father is very like go forward. So I think I listen to trust in my instinct as well, listening to advice. But and the last thing is not being afraid to fail. If you do something good in health, you know, really, I really promise, I don't feel the pressure to fail. And I think they haven't either. It will give you some strength because when you're a doctor, you see people having very severe things, disease, you know, that you can cure. And it makes you very humble about life and really help you to say that if you fail what you're doing, there is worse thing in life, which is your health. Health matters more than anything else. I mean, so my parents have been very cool about failing, even when I was a kid at school. If I was failing anything, they were always super cool about it, not really pressurizing me anything and giving me the right values. And I think it really helped me. And you know, when I stopped being a doctor, they were like super supportive. And some parents could have said, you should stay with your job, you know. But however, they're not really helping me day to day, you know. They haven't helped me on deals still because they want me to succeed. They're not helping me. I mean, the American way, really.
Yeah, that's kind of...
And this gives me the, I want to make my own money. I want to make my own job. I want to make my own success. And I want to do better than them. That's kind of what's driving me. And you know, I'm not working. I never work with Actelion or Idorsia. I'm making my own stuff. My father always made the joke saying I'm the father of Thomas Closer. This is how he present me, just for the joke. And I hope one day will mean something. Today, not that much. Today, like, okay, who is this guy? Well, you know, I don't know. But it's, you know, but like, ah, like, my parents always take huge bets.
I like a lot
the
inspiration lessons part, but also very hands off and like giving you the freedom to explore, to fail, to build yourself and to build yourself differently. I think it's, yeah.
And it's also
very good mix.
Being single-minded, my father, my mother, they refused all the boards. They are not in any boards. They're only in, my father is only in an Idorsia board, and my mother say no to hundreds of boards. Just because they also teach me to be single-minded. Think about one thing you want to do in life well and just do it. Don't, you know, there's so many people that love to be board people, being in ex, they don't care. They're really out of the radar at every point of view.
Yeah, I can tell you, your dad is very focused also on PR, or at least I never managed to
do it. Yeah, he never do anything. He doesn't care. He never do anything. He doesn't invest. He doesn't do anything else. No,
it's pretty impressive. I mean, impressive. Actually, I have to say, it works.
But they are doctors. Always remember, they're just doctors. They really don't see. They really believe that all the patients giving the drugs is their own patients. They really are.
On the focus, it's funny because your dad is very focused and you apply this, but at the same time, I heard you in an interview on Fast Company about that you want to be more unfocused and being open to every opportunity versus being ultra focused, and that a lot of VCs challenged you on that of saying, well, where is the focus?
No, I think it's exactly so. At the beginning, I had so many board members, a few members say, you have to do one thing, take one modality, pathology. Just do one use case. And I was like, I want to build a net of technology that will help to understand what the right use case. Because once again, this is new technologies for the healthcare. We don't really know what we're really discovering and how much is going to impact patients tomorrow. I want to be way more open and a very more unsupervised mindset. And they were all, I know you need to be focused. And I've never agreed to be focused in for Hawking. I've always agreed to go large and to be ambitious and try to cross-fertilize things, because it does cross-fertilize. And so, of course, like, I got one board member that had to fire me once.
I guess you learn from your dad there, no? He had some lessons to share, no?
The lessons from my dad, which is like...
was an activist investor. I heard about the story. It was like, well...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, well. No, but you, yeah. I mean, the board is a big topic, you know, for a company like us, because, you know, it's very hard to get board members that get to the right level of understanding of what you do. We have some but it's not an easy topic. So no. And I've always fight for what I believe. And these companies, all of us, we are moonshot companies in situ, in silico, Exantia. I mean, we want to try to change big stuff. And at the same time, as of course, all the big tech people have. We're not like an operation heavy. I mean, we have to be in some ways, and most of us will fail, maybe me too, but I think it's fine. We all have to be in this mindset, and focus is the way to go.
I like that too. Choosing the case for when to be ultra focused and when to be less focused. I can see for me personally, it's something that I learned recently, and I try to be much more like malleable, or how you say in English, or more like flexible.
Yeah, more.
Rather than, I was like very rigid, like always ultra focused, always deep work and like very rigid. And I find that in some cases, whether it's with a company or whether it's even personal or whatever, or in the time of project, sometimes... like choosing the right setting of focus works actually better.
I think it's exactly, that's good. And I think also it's the same when you go out for a walk and when you are sitting at your desk. When you're sitting at your desk, you're in a mode, it's a concentration mode. You know, you really focus. When you go out to walk, you're more attentive. It's called attention versus concentration. Mm-hmm. You're more, you know, ideas coming and flowing and everything. And I think to be successful, you need both. You need to mm-hmm. walk out and be sitting at your desk. You need to focus on the mission, and you need to have very precise key objective and key results. You need to have you need to know what you're solving. Sometimes people don't know the problem they're solving. You need to have a clear vision on data. You need to know the technology you want to be number one on. You need to be always number one. We are number one on multi-scale AI for biology, but then you need to be also attentive to what the world to ideas that come in. You know, you need to be both. I think to do a bit of both, and usually people try to make you only go for the focus side.
Yeah, that's. I like that. On the maybe a bit on the other personal topic is on fun. I like a lot, like that, at least it seems, but even from our discussion, that you're having fun in what you do. I remember you were like, whatever, doing interview and wearing like a pink elephant sweater, and I messaged you about this, and then you just posted about the JPM blue bike. I mean, It's small things, but first it's about having fun day to day and even making a bit more public and have it, sharing that fun. Can you like, first, I like that a lot, and I can connect to it and relate to it, but can you elaborate a bit more on like, yeah, maybe what's behind it. Like it?
First, yeah, thank you. No, I think like, once again, I know what's important. I mean, The being a doctor and oncologist for not that many years, but enough to understand what that health is the only thing that matters, your health, your family, your friends. The rest is a cool top on. Being a billionaire, you're still going to die, not going to absolutely be more happy. I mean, I know that I think I understood my own way to think. It's like health really matters, my family, my friends. The rest is a great top on, and it's just an adventure. That's the first one. Then I think, you know, my way, you know, I think I love to have challenges in life. It makes everybody happy, makes me happy. And there are doable challenges. And Oakley is an amazing challenge. Very hard company. I need 2 aspirins after every day. Or each board, 4 aspirins probably, maybe 20. But it's also super doable. Maybe we can achieve it. And it's so amazing. And the last thing is, I'm surrounded by so cool people. We keep the culture at Oakley very childish culture, and that is, you know, about being, you know, together. We are playing games with the Pictionary yesterday, you know, together. And I think I love the people, and it makes me so happy to have people that I actually really do love. I think we are 320 people. There is nobody I could not have a lunch with. There is none, and that makes me so fulfilling, you know, in a way. But the most side of it is, you know, if it fails, it fails. I promise I won't be, you know, because life is bigger than that, and my human adventure with my colleagues is the best thing I've created in the company, and I really mean it, and I love so many of them like from the bottom of my heart. So I think it's something that makes me just giving a bit lighter heart, because, you know, and this is where doing something like you know, we are all in the same space, right? Having a social impact in life gives you less pressure, because you did your best, you know, like you help, you're trying to help. And people that just work in the big tech, but don't understand what the impact they want to create socially, I think they're missing something. At least it gives them more pressure. Yeah. You know, if I was building an NFT company for whatever, I would feel way more pressure. I had to succeed, but I don't.
NFT for
well, NFT for, I don't know, for us.
For biotech, somebody, I don't know what that looks.
Well, we could do that too. I don't know. I mean, there's great companies around that as well. It's just not my stuff.
I like that.
But you invited. I hope you're gonna come on our. Please, are you at JP Morgan? We have to do our tuk-tuk tour. Tuk-tuk at JP Morgan. It's gonna be because I want to be outside. I hate to be inside. So we're gonna have hot chocolates. We're gonna be outside. We're gonna go by the water, by the Embarcadero, come back to the Union Square. So I really hope we can come and everybody can enjoy our tuk-tuk meetings.
I will show the picture post. It looks really cool. I like this mindset because on pressure. I mean, I like your view that because you are doing something with a high impact, this relieves pressure. But my feeling also is that quite a lot of people, let's say in the industry, because it's such a serious topic and high pressure. I mean, you're talking about people with cancer or like really heavy stuff, sometimes they become, I feel like, very serious about it and like, you know, a bit, let's say, not boring, but it's a bit judgment, but a bit like too serious, too stiff. Which I quite like your view of it, because basically it's the same, like, whatever, the same cause, but the interpretation or how you go about it is completely different. And I feel like, yeah, I like that.
I mean, I think both make sense. Don't get me wrong. Both make sense. I mean, we also need people that feel the pressure. I mean, it's not because you feel less pressure that you don't feel the sense of urgency. It's different,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I do feel the sense of urgency for the patients. I mean, it's unbelievable that we still have cancer with this level of understanding. Take cholangiocarcinoma. It's increasing. We don't get it. Where is it coming from? It did not exist 20 years ago. What's the food effects on it? You know, whatever. We are so you have to be super humble about what you're building, because the biology makes you humble. But I feel like we also need people that are stressed out. I mean, it's just not my way to go. And I'm not saying I'm never stressed. I am sometimes. But, you know, at the end, it's so hard. Biology is really hard. I'm so grateful for people that work there as well. Everybody in the tech, in the biotech, in the big pharma, in the labs, in academics, even more in academics where people don't make so much money. I'm so grateful, because you can see so much money around like the new large language model, the new Me Too of OpenAI raising a lot of money. Cool, but it's amazing. But and having like small biotech startup having so much hard time to raise money, it gives me like, you know, sometimes a little bit and I'm a bit angry. But it's like, and you have to be, you know. So I'm really grateful for the people that work in health, wherever.
I like that. Still on the fun topic, what I quite like is that I think even if it's serious, if you need the urgency, I think just having fun at work or having fun with your colleague is just something so like fundamental from a human level, or at least for some personality of people, it's so fundamental that I think if you don't have it, you cannot do like really good work. Do you see that as well?
I think so too. Yeah, complete. I mean, if you don't like to come to the office in the morning, you know, it's hard, because, you know, I think also the work environment is, the more you grow, the more you have to be closer to some type of woke principles. Woke is being like trying to create new minorities. And I think we resisted quite well for now. It's not easy, you know. We have to keep fresh. You have to keep. And I think like also being more European company, it's easier. You know, a little bit.
Why is it easier? You're less exposed to the woke virus in the US. So.
Yes.
I don't want to be political,
No. But we're still very careful about these values. And American has also brought really important values, and we're very respectful of diversity and everything. And I just say like, it's harder to talk about religion or things like this, for example, or politics in the US. You have to be a bit more careful. And we also have a big US company, but our French spirits, we're quite free. we are really revolutionary company. I mean, our company is like, we know we're very like, my co-founder, Gilles, was probably the smartest people I've ever met in my life and one of the coolest. He's so French, you know. He was like, when we had Google Venture coming in the company, he was like, we have to say no. We have to be the first company saying no to Google Venture. And he was like, and he really meant it. I mean, he meant it. And Gilles has always been seeing
revolutionary
and very revolutionary. But he's the coolest guy around.
But you still said yes at the end, or both of you.
Yeah, I don't know. So we got a bit of American pragmatism. American pragmatism coming again.
When you saw the money on the table as well, and I mean, and the money and the value, I guess. How is it actually to have Google Ventures as investors? Because they invested quite a lot. I mean, I think they're in Pass AI as well. And then obviously with Google background, I mean, the crazy view on AI in general, and they have also their own, let's say, bio efforts. So how was it?
Yeah, no, I have nothing specific to say. I mean, they've been supportive and nice. I mean, I mean, we were the first, I think, in Europe when they invested at the time, after they made more investments. So we were the first deal. I think what happened at Google is, it's not really about Google Venture. It's not about the funds that invest, it's about the partner. And at the time, we had somebody called Adam Gobara that has created Top Harvest Capital, and which is one of the coolest people I met in my work life. He's been always super founders friendly, always supporting us, and with a real vision for the company. And he knew why he was investing. He, you want people that are not in what we call momentum investing, which is a lot for a lot of VCs are investing because other people are investing. You want people that invest because they have a very, very precise theory about what you want to do. You really want, and I also took momentum money, and I probably shouldn't have, because the people that are coming because other people are here and not the people that are bringing you value. You want people that, we had the same with Gwendo Raya from First Capital that invested at the beginning because he believed in us, in the vision. It's more about the partners and the funds, really.
Okay. Can you share a bit more about this momentum money and like the slash the fit investors?
Yeah, I mean, for example, at the beginning, we had like people like Nicole Juckerman. She's a German, amazing investor. Jörg Mohrhoff, like First, Google. I think they're Adam Gobara. This is really people more than funds that Jackie Abidbon from Qatar that really believe in us. They were really like believing in the story. They didn't care if an American fund was coming or whatever, or another fund was here. A lot of funds are just waiting for leads to come, for the diligence to be done. And when they see good names, they're just coming in. And it's part of the problem of venture capital is they really work by FOMO, right? We all know that. Some results, but there is amazing stuff. Take the example of Sophie Nova. Sophie Nova has been an amazing biotech fund, as you know. And those are creating this great digital fund. And I think like Ed and Simon, the two partners, have really, really a strong view on things. And they understand the intersection. So that we start to have in this field people that have, that have balls and that have ideas. But we also have people that just want to invest because whatever, blah, 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 blah.
I was about to mention Sophie Nova. It's great. But I think talk about this maybe from your perspective on like, because, there is always a level of FOMO that is, let's say, healthy or that works. I mean, especially when you talk about venture rounds. I mean, I don't know if you're talking about angels coming at the beginning. I mean, angels, there is a bit more believing and really the fit with the person and really long-term investing. But let's say from a VC, I mean, you need to be in this, like, sweet spot of, okay, it's not too early, it's not too late, and what will be my return, kind of having a decent return possibility. And this is also very dependent on let's say the market, other investors, pharma partners who for them they quite like momentum and follow also a lot of others, and the public market, which is very momentum based as well. So how do you wrap all of this around and then you take the decision of which investor to take? Like you build an AI model for this?
I think it's a personal fit thing as well. I think it's like colleagues. You want to take people that you want to work with. I mean, I took people that I did not want to work with in the past, I'm really choosing. It's the people. It's not the name. It's not the rating, because people made a difference. So I think you have to take people, and you have to understand what part of momentum investing or what part of like real theory. You have to ask them, why are you here? Why do you want to work with me? The problem is, what is the actual value in our company, in tech bio in general? There is people that bring you great insights, but I have to say the truth, money is money. Because nobody has done this before, right? So it's very rare that somebody's going to bring you, at the earliest stage, nobody's going to bring you something dramatic. Then when you have to structure, when you need to understand better, when you have to position the drug, then they're going to come and help a lot. At the beginning, I think it's more functional than just exponential, in what they can bring to you.
I like that. And actually,
I'm going to be loved by the VC community.
It's good. I mean, you will have it.
Good. They're not going to like me, but I don't care.
Yeah, you work with Sophie Nova already as venture partner or something, so it's okay.
I have to mention, true. But because I really believe in Ed and Simon, and they prove me right.
Sure. it's a great
thing.
They're
very fun guys. They're fun guys. So it's fun as well. I think also like we have taken as board observers people from Sanofi, Frank Nestlé, and Venkat from BMS, and I think like Venkat leading like a big part of data science, Frank the discovery, they've been amazing to help us. I really recommend for people to take also people from the industry in as board observers or board directors. I just like to help you build things because I have an industry view. That is also super interesting. And for me, they've been extremely helpful.
Yeah, that's makes especially on, as you said, on certain aspect of your business or your case where it is kind of industry, where there is some industry part and industry knowledge needed. I mean, I want to ask you one question also on the investor side, because and actually, I think you've built it working more as a tech company as well, as in like raising money, but with not too much dilution. And even, I mean, when Sanofi invested, I think it was 180 million, but at a 1 billion valuation, I think they got 10-15% of equity, which is quite low and a very big multiple, much more tech multiple than a biotech multiple, where probably they would have, whatever, 30-50% of the company. And I guess what translates behind as well is that you guys as founders still have much more, say, control or things to say on the actual company versus the typical model in biotech where a VC fund will come in and take quite a lot of control. Sorry. Can you hear me? The question is more like, is that the case? And can you elaborate a bit on it?
We don't have control.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we were not very dilution sensitive with my co-founder, because I always prefer to have a very small part of a huge company, which is not huge today. So I hope Okin will become huge. So we were not really, we took the money when we had a really great fund that came in, and we took the money where it's coming from. And so we took maybe too many rounds. So we got dilution. However, we don't control the company, my co-founder and I. But we're careful, of course. You know, we're careful to still try to get the right dilution and everything. But you know, we are not in the position where we control the company, which maybe is healthy as well. You know, because it's such a complex thing, you want more people to control it. But I think, you know, the more you grow, it's my first company, right? So you know, I learned that you know, of course, like dilution matters for the control of it a lot. So you know,
but I mean, you don't control maybe. You don't control more than 50% with your co-founder, I guess, but you still have more shares than in a typical biotech setup where the founder ends up with whatever 4% or 2-3 or 1-3% or something.
Maybe, yeah, for now.
Yeah. For now.
More than that, but you know, not 50% either.
Yeah.
But you know, I think like, you know, we when there is good money coming in, and because we have to build, you know, technology, we have to find data, we have to build molecules, we have so much to do. It's a costly project, so you know, we're taking the money, and you cannot really like do like bootstrap it and the money and program your own thing. It doesn't work out, because in biology, all the wet lab thing also works a lot. This is the problem of biology. You always need fundings.
You need a lot of cash, and as we discussed on the whole field as well, I mean, the field is moving so fast, and you have quite some competitors as well, and like, you need to move also fast to be relevant and to still be the best.
While keeping always years of cash ahead of you, you know. Mm-hmm. At Okin, we have at least 3 years of cash ahead of us. It matters, because you have to be careful with that.
Yeah. That's great. It's great, Thomas. I think we are about time. Was a great discussion. I hope the audio worked. I think it worked. Normally it records offline. I think it worked. At least this will be. We will edit.
Yeah, I think you were sent them a little pixelized, and I love the hat. What is your hat for this weekend, this winter? You gotta take it for skiing.
It's my Christmas hat.
It's so cool. You have Christmas hats. I love your Christmas hat.
Actually,
see you soon.
Wait. I forgot we need to take a picture together so I can put the hat on. Can you just say hi? Great. Thanks for listening to the end. I really enjoyed the conversation. I think this topic is really complex, and there's a lot of like hype and everyone talks, I'm doing AI in biotech, but I think Thomas, I really tried to challenge him, and I think he's really good at answering, but I think he nailed it pretty well of explaining also what's the key differences between really native tech bio, AI biotechs, what Okin is doing. I really like the approach of starting with the patient data and really like a huge amount of data and quality data, and then going backwards towards assets instead of having a pipeline versus a lot of other AI tool tools where it's harder to capture value in biotech. I hope you enjoyed as well. If you did, please hit the like, subscribe, review button, especially if you're on Spotify or Apple. And I would be also curious to hear what you think. So please, if you're on YouTube, if you can, or Spotify, you can comment directly. Or you can also send me an email to philip@flot.bio. All right, catch you in the next one.